15 minutes for rebuttal.
If I avoid using 2 minutes, I'd like to reserve that.
All right. Well, we'll warn you when the 2 minutes arrives, and the yellow light will tell you that as well, of course. So you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the Court, I'm Russ Watson. I'm a member of the Chesterfield County Bar Association. I represent Mr. Osvedon in this appeal from a divorce action out of the Circuit Court of Rockland County, Judge Hammond. A number of assignments of error were initially noted on the final decree. I've withdrawn the ones that I really felt were of no import. What's remaining, I see, believe, fall into basically three different issues, and the spousal support.
Can I ask you, because I hate to interrupt you, Mr. Watson,
yes,
but you know when you're up here, time goes by really fast. On the debt and the trial court's division of the debt.
Yes.
In closing argument, Mrs. Osvedon's attorney talked about the credit that husband should perhaps would be fair for husband to get. And the trial court did not seem to follow that. But the trial court seemed to make some findings at the end when she apportioned the debt, when she was doing the equitable distribution, where she said, well, she seemed to be, it was sort of cryptically said, but she seemed to say that your client had taken credit cards out in his wife's name that the wife didn't know about and then had charged up a lot of money on them. And it could that be the reasoning for why in equitable distribution she gave nearly all of the debts to your client except for that one credit card of about $3,500 that went to Mrs. Osvedon?
I think that would have been a proper rationale had the evidence supported and the court found that the debts were separate. And in fact, neither of the parties ever suggested otherwise throughout all the pleadings, the schemes, and Ms. Osvedon's own proposed scheme of equitable distribution. It was all noted, granted, conceded that the debts were marital. No evidence suggested that it was ever used for any separate, improper, or non-marital purpose.
Even though she didn't know about those credit cards or what had been charged on them?
There was some testimony to that effect. It was disputed by Mr. Osvedon. I'm not clear on what the judge's actual findings on that were. But even if that were the case, the classification and purpose of the debt, I think, is what is critical to the determination. If there was some suggestion that he'd taken out debt in her name and used it for non-marital purpose or for his own separate purposes, that would be a reason, a rationale, in order to apportion it to him.
Hammond did find that he had engaged in some waste and dissipation.
Correct.
Was that pre-separation, post-separation, or is it clear what her finding was on that?
I would say that was, as I recall, the mostly post-separation.
But when he sold one car and bought another, and et cetera, I think that was what post-separation.
I'm not aware. I don't recall any instances in which it was pre-separation. Where I think the court misstepped with regards to the waste, sure, if he dissipated it and you use that as a factor to make an unequal distribution, fine. But what she did was she ordered him to restore the waste and then still use that as a factor.
And use a specific dollar figure to restore the waste too, right?
Which turned out to be more than 50% of what was found to have been dissipated. So, as I see it, she starts out with husband made the majority of the monetary contributions. It's in the supplementary, the supplemental appendix. And if you do the math, he's 800 and something thousand to her 100,000 during the course of the marriage. And she makes that finding. And I think the evidence supports it. And then she says, but that is negated by the installment debt. And frankly, why that is, I don't know. It's illogical. There's no explanation. But if that's the case, we go from positive contributions negated. That moves us kind of back to neutral, as I see it, as far as the equal distribution. Then she says, well, there was waste. But then she has him restore it by her order. So once again, I think we're back to neutral. And then she says, well, you know, there was alcohol abuse during the marriage, and the evidence was clear on the date of the separation. Mr. Osvedon woke up out of a drunken stupor. There was an assault, and he hurt Ms. Osvedon. And I think that probably drove the judge's opinion more than anything, because, you know, it seems like, you know, the third factor was, well, he was a bad guy, and I'm going to punish him in this equitable distribution as a result of that.
Well, in her opinion letter, she says, husband made the majority of the positive monetary contributions, but these are negated by the installment debt of more than $35,000, implying that she thinks he didn't manage the money very well. Husband committed waste of marital property after separation. And then she says husband's misconduct led directly to the dissolution of the marriage. But she mentions the other things before she mentions his you know, assault and breaking his wife's arm.
She does. She also mentions, and I think it was clear from the evidence, if anything was clear, she mentions the parties throughout their marriage lived beyond their means. And that was supported by he worked several jobs at one time. He was using the credit card debt to try to meet the monthly expenses.
Can you help me understand from the record, if we can get it from the record? Obviously, on appellate court, we have to get it only from the record. But they have a home worth about $197,000, doesn't seem to be living beyond their means. They get the furniture through, this used furniture through Craigslist. Where are they living beyond their means? I mean, it seems money is just going out, and he's working two jobs and making between the two jobs about $113,000, $114,000 a year, right?
Yes.
And you add them together. Where are they living beyond their means? I couldn't find it.
Well, in the sense that they continue to borrow on what were clearly marital family purchases. I mean, no one did an audit of the financial, you know, history of the marriage, but there was no evidence, none even suggested by Ms. Osvedon, that there's some secret, you know, pool of money that's being accumulated as a result of it. So I can't answer in the. I don't think it is.
It's not in the
clear
record.
In the record where mathematically you could say, well, we can see here. I mean, we have just all this accumulating debt, a refinance of the house, things that are all indicative of a family struggling to meet ends.
And the house is now, the value of the house is a negative. It's underwater or close to it.
Very close to it. It could go either way.
Sorry, I don't mean to take you off your argument.
That's fine. Judge, if I may, in our view, the spousal support really is the more important issue of the two, and I certainly don't want to run out of time before right. I address that. And the issue,
I got a feeling you're going to talk about 20-79.
Yes, sir. I have to, because I think that answers the question. And there's also, in addition to the plain language of that statute, as well as the Virginia Supreme Court touched on it in the Werner decision, granted that was back in 1972, but I don't believe the statute's changed in any significant part since then. It just makes sense to rule as Judge Hammond did, that the needy spouse, or you don't even get to that point, in order for her to decrease support, then Ms. Osvedon would have had to request it in her complaint. And you have to understand, we put a written motion before the court asking the court to determine spousal support. But to make that finding effectively puts the keys to the courthouse in the needy spouse's hands. And why is that important? Why would someone want to do that? Well, it's very simple, and it's very strategic, And there's nothing wrong with it under our statutory scheme of what Ms. Osvedon did. But upon divorce, she goes to the juvenile court and she petitions for spousal support, and the juvenile court applies the guidelines and makes an award. She files for divorce. She doesn't request spousal support in her divorce decree. So the juvenile pendente litis award continues. Mr. Osvedon tries to bring the issue before the circuit court. Circuit court says, no, I can't do it. So what is left is then he has to go back potentially.
Clear something. What did Judge Hammond do with that appeal? There was an appeal from J&D Court, correct?
Well, that's the beauty of it, Judge. That's the beauty. She found, and although that is not in this divorce action, you asked the question. The beauty of it is she found her jurisdiction was derivative and she entered a support award based on the guideline and actually attached the guideline worksheet to the order. We have an indefinite pendente litis award.
And no evidentiary hearing in her court.
Well, no. I mean, there was an evidentiary hearing. I mean, she took evidence in the case of CJ-14-whatever.
That was the March 10th hearing, 2014?
I think that went back. I think that was in June.
There was a show cause hearing on June 9th, 2014, and then the de novo appeal in circuit court from the JDR court spousal support modification hearing was March 10th.
Yes,
and,
that was the
and we don't have that in the appendix, right, or in the...
Well, it was a separate action.
Right. But that's when she dealt with the spousal support order from the JNDR court.
When she heard the appeal, yes. Mm-hmm. And
so the result of that, you're saying, and can you answer this from the record, please?
Well.
Is that there's an order, but it's essentially leaving the JNDR court spousal support order in effect indefinitely. That right?
Well, from the record, that order, well, I have it right here before this court, but it's she took evidence, heard evidence, Ortinas received exhibits, heard argument on an appeal of a motion to amend. She found the party's incomes. She applied those incomes. She even found, made a finding that Mr. Osvedon was underemployed to the tune of $230 a month, and she stuck all those numbers into the guideline formula and produced a number that became and is the current spousal support award.
So it's not the amount that was in the JDR court. It's a new amount.
It's a new amount using application of the pendente litis guidelines.
But you're saying that doesn't matter because... The issue was, should she not have dealt with spousal support because of your pleading, which was sort of later in the process, but still,
absolutely,
while it was before her, she should have dealt with it as a circuit court because of Werner versus Commonwealth in the statute.
Because the court had made an equitable distribution and we were no longer pendente litis, and a formula simply putting 30% of his gross income. One, there's no basis in law. Completely, the train has run off the procedural tracks at this point. The court has to take into account the equitable distribution, particularly when, in this instance, the payor spouse has been apportioned 89% of the marital debt, totaling $35,000.
Well, obviously, on such spousal support, you have to take into consideration equitable distribution. Of course, that wasn't done at all.
No. And so we're asking the circuit court, great, everything's done. You've heard the evidence. You've made your findings. Since the day of separation till today, the wife has been receiving temporary support. It's now time for you to determine permanent support. And obviously one of the things
and
we
you requested
would like,
that at what date again? Refresh my memory.
I'm sorry.
When did you request that? When did you request the circuit court to do that?
I believe the date of the filing was March 16. Now, one of the problems we had is, if you recall from the record, at hearings, there'd been a discussions back in November. There was a motion to reconsider. The court actually set the March date to hear spousal support. And then we got there and she said, wait, I can't do it. I don't have a motion. And you know what? She was right at that point. Even though we'd talked about it for months, she was right because neither party had pled it.
And that's what she said at the reconsideration hearing on February
18th? No, I believe it was, yes, correct. And so we filed the motion at that point. Now,
And I'm sorry, I did not remind you when
that's
you got
okay.
You two
I've noted
minutes,
that I'm out of time.
Well, we've asked you a lot of questions. So if you would, you know, finish what you were saying in regard to that, and then I'll give you a minute to a rebuttal. I'll give Ms. Evans additional time, too.
Right. Judge, clearly she didn't follow the clear meaning of the statute. She had a written motion before her asking her to decree to support her. She declined to do so on a basis that is not supported by law. The error is far from harmless because the result of the error is one to deprive a party of a basic right, that is for the court, the circuit court, the trial court of record to determine spousal support, and two, because of the statutory structure of this concurrent jurisdiction and such with the juvenile court, we're now saddled with what is in effect, in fact, an indefinite pendente litis spousal support award. And in order to correct that, well, you can imagine procedurally what would be involved in the repetition of the presentation of the same evidence that she was hearing as part of the divorce action.
After she heard the appeal and thus entered the order following that, did she remand it back down to JDR?
Yes. Yes. Judge, we've spoke briefly about on the equitable distribution, the debt and the property. They're just simply, the court has broad discretion to do what it deems is right. But when you start from the premise that a marriage is an economic partnership and what this statutory scheme attempts to do is to allow or distribute a fair portion to each party, the court in this instance clearly missed the boat, and what has been offered by the court as rationale and the evidence before the court simply doesn't support it because it's just that grossly disproportionate. And lastly, Judge, because the IRA, and it's a small matter, it's only a couple $1,000s, but because the IRA was not jointly titled, she had no authority to order Mr. Osvedon to transfer it directly to Ms. Osvedon. She certainly could have skinned the cat another way, but she didn't have the statutory authority to do it that way.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. Ms. Evans, good morning.
Good morning. Please support Mr. Evans on behalf of Pamela Osvedon this morning.
Could I clear up a couple of quick things, if I may, please? By what authority did Judge Hammond transfer this IRA, order this transfer?
Your Honor, I would concede that under subsection C, she does not have the authority.
She could not.
She could not. In preparing for today, I think arguably the only leg that I would have to stand on is
do you concede that error?
Yes, sir.
Well, going on to another point, and that's the point about the request for hearing on spousal, 20-79.
Yes, sir.
Why did Judge Hammond err in not having that hearing?
I don't believe she erred in having that hearing.
I'm sorry?
No, she did not err in her decision to not hear the spousal support or make it as part of the decree. There is absolutely no requirement that as part of a divorce, the divorce court hear matters of spousal support. My client had the absolute right to have the matter heard before the juvenile court. There were multiple hours of hearing before the juvenile court.
No question about that, but what does the statute mean when it says either party may request?
Either party may request. She did not request it. Part of our argument, Your Honor, is that it's a personal
request.
But
it says either party.
It does. It says either party may request and that spouse may be awarded. So our argument is that none of the case law says that either party may request on behalf of either party. It's not. There's no case law that says when either party requests it, it's just a blanket subject.
But doesn't
that's before
Werner,
the
Supreme Court in Werner, say either Werner or his wife could have asked the circuit court to make specific provision in the final divorce decree for allowance or denial of alimony?
I That Winter does say that, but I don't believe that that is dispositive language. I think the other evidence that I presented in my brief is more compelling as to the fact that it is a personal request, and it's meant to be a personal request. Wright v. Wright says that a party has to request it or has requested in his or her own pleadings. The statutory language itself says when either party so requests for the spouse versus either spouse.
Would it be a violation of Wright v. Wright for it to be requested in a motion that's made later on, as was done in this case?
Well, and I believe
that's still within the bosom of the court, of course.
I believe that those are the two prongs on which the request for support was properly denied by the court. I'll note that the court had heard, and we'd had multiple hearings of which Mr. Morton was not, Watson was not involved until later on in the proceedings. We had had the evidentiary hearing in November. He was not a part of that. Mr. Osvedan was pro se. Mr. Watson came on. He filed a motion to reconsider. He did not, in his motion to reconsider, list spousal support at all. We had a hearing on a motion to reconsider. Evidence was heard and taken on that. The court made a ruling from the bench.
I mean, it's late in the process.
But you don't have
a final decree until June, a final order rather until June, and this is made in March. Why isn't that still within the bosom of the court?
Your Honor, the court had made a ruling. The court made its ruling, I believe, on March the 10th. She gave gave counsel 30 days to draft a final decree. An oral ruling of the court is an order that stands. And so at that point, no evidence was permitted to be taken. No further evidence would be heard. All that was left to be done was to draft the decree. Mr. Watson filed his motion to decree spousal support 2 days before the final decree was due. And at that point, while technically the matter was still open, I don't believe that it was proper for the court to reopen it for the taking of more evidence on that hearing, especially when he had ample opportunity. There's case law that
now,
Can
I ask you on that, Ms. Evans? You said he filed it only 2 days before the final decree. You said was due. She was going to do it on March the 21st or something like that? Because he either made it on March 16th or March 19th, it looks like, according to my records here. Am I wrong on that?
I have March 18th, so...
Okay, well, somewhere in there.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. By my recollection, it was 2 days before the final decree was actually due.
And that was... due based on what Judge Hammond had said.
Right. She made the oral ruling from the bench and said, counsel, I want you to draft the order, have it to the court within 30 days is the normal procedure. And so for all intents and purposes, the case was done. It was just a matter of scribing the order itself. I'll note, Your Honor, that in Wright v. Wright, it discusses, the husband in that case had argued that wife's request for reservation of support, which was done in her motion to reconsider, was untimely. The court did not agree and noted that the party had already requested spousal support in his or her pleadings, and there's no bar from receiving, from the court receiving, or from the party receiving spousal support. I think that that distinguishes this case because in that case, they specifically relied on the fact that he had made that request, or the wife had made that request in her motion to reconsider. Again, we not only did not have it in the motion to reconsider, we didn't have it in prior to the hearing on the motion to reconsider. We had it several weeks after the
hearing. Is the trial court supposed to consider equitable distribution in setting spousal support?
If it's properly before the court, certainly. And we had this discussion, Judge Hammonds and I kind of went back and forth because her initial thought was that it had to be done by the court. And then she went back in chambers and came back and said that was not correct. And that's why she ultimately said it does
that's
not.
That's when she noted the statute that shows that, that under which it was done in J&DR court here.
Yes, yes. I believe she had a clerk do some case law research and actually came back and actually provided a letter noting the case law. And found that there was no case law that said that a divorce court had to remove the matter that had been heard by the juvenile court and have it decided by the circuit court instead. It stands as a completely separate order. And so I would argue, and she asked me the same thing, isn't this then a pendente lite order that just never ends? And my response is no, it's not a pendente lite order. It's a valid juvenile court order, just as if the parties had never been married, had never gone to divorce court, the juvenile court could enter the spousal support order, which does have an indefinite timeline. There's nothing that says that once a divorce proceeding opens, that the juvenile court order has to be transferred for the judge to decide so that they could consider equitable distribution. Arguably, the legislature could fix that, but the present standing of the law is that it can stay that way.
Are you saying that the J&D order was not a pendente lite order?
Not in the context of what we would consider to be a pendente lite order entered by the circuit court.
Okay.
It's a final order.
All right.
And the juvenile court, in deciding that, knew that there was a divorce proceeding going on and had no issues with it.
So even if Judge Hammond could have just left that alone, I mean, based on your argument, she could have just left it alone. Could she have done that here when, sort of back to the question of timeliness, I guess, but do you argue that husband's counsel could not have brought this up earlier before the motion for reconsideration and she would have had to have dealt with it?
I think you're asking if I would then concede that it's not a personal request, that he could have, if he had done it in a timely manner, made that request on behalf of Ms. Osvedan. And I'm not conceding that argument. I think that there still would be the issue of she's not requesting it for herself and that she's not requesting a remedy of the court.
So you think that Werner is just, we're just misinterpreting Werner as either party can raise it for provision or denial of spousal support?
No, I think that Werner states that a party can raise the issue of spousal support for themselves, and they can either be granted or denied spousal support. I don't believe that Werner stands for the proposition that either party can request it for either party.
Well, why would it say denial then, or denial? Because no party's going to ask that they be denied spousal support.
But the court, I don't read it as saying that the party could ask for denial. I read it as saying the court could either grant or deny.
But suppose, for tactical reasons, the husband wants to get this out of the way now as part of the entire proceeding. I want to get this spousal support set now. he cannot ask the court, I want you to set spousal support in this case?
I don't believe so. I don't believe that the way that the statute is currently written that is the case. I believe that if the legislature wants to write it so that it is construed that way, then they should draft it that way.
And so if a husband made that request, if the husband made that motion, Judge, I want you to set spousal support in this matter, or address spousal support in this matter, why should we assume that he's requesting spousal support to go to his wife? Why should we assume that?
I'm not assuming it. I'm saying that whoever is requesting it is making it for themselves. The assumption is made that if you're asking the court to consider spousal mm-hmm. support, that it's a request for yourself. It's a personal request, whether you're the husband or the wife.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Evans, I don't want to steal Judge Beals' thunder, but in reading directly from Werner, says either Werner or his wife could have asked the circuit court to make specific provision in the final divorce decree for allowance or denial of alimony. How do we read that not as providing just what Judge Beals is asking about?
I would concede that it could be interpreted that way, but again, I think the fact that the statute says for the spouse as opposed to a spouse, meaning that if a party requests it, then it can be awarded for the spouse, contradicts Werner. I think that the other case law, which talks about a party requesting it in his or her pleadings, makes it a personal right. It's a matter of first impression from the research that I could tell, and I don't know that anybody has said, does Werner conflict with
said
this
it
other?
It could be interpreted that way. Hasn't it been interpreted that way? Just as Judge Hatley recited?
I believe that the way that the Werner decision is written doesn't specifically address the direct question of can a party. I think that it's written to address the issues in Werner overall, but I don't think it has directly addressed is it a personal request? Can a person request it for the other party? As far as
they're not requesting it for the other party, though, as Judge Haley noted, they're making a decision that we want this court to deal with it now and to perhaps deny it as opposed to grant it. So why, if given, as Judge Atlee said, what the Supreme Court said in Werner, and given the statute, why don't we have to read it as either party, as long as they raise it timely, either party can ask for either provision of spousal support or denial of it to the other spouse?
I think it's a matter of debate, hence why we're here. I don't think that there is case law that says definitively either way that that is how Werner should be interpreted. I'm asking this court to interpret it when and taken in conjunction with the wording of the statute and other case law that it is a personal right. If obviously precedent comes into play that says, no, this is exactly what Werner means, then that's different. But I did not find that precedent, and so that's the crux of the debate on the spousal support other than the timeliness issue.
So I guess it makes no difference to you when this motion was made by the other side. They couldn't make it in any event. Is that correct?
Well, it's two parts of my argument, two unrelated parts. It helps me that it was untimely, and then I have something else to fall back on, of course, but I think they stand on their own. If I may briefly address while I have a couple of minutes, as far as the evidentiary support for the award, and the court briefly touched upon it, I would echo what the court said as far as living beyond the party's means. And the court asked directly about how they got into this mess. The evidence in the record, or the record does show, for example, that the husband made a $10,000 loan, and he really did not have a good explanation as to why he did that. And it also, he did concede on examination that he had experimented throughout the marriage with different business enterprises. And I think when taken in conjunction with this loan that he had made for no good reason, the court inferred that throughout the marriage there had been these risky financial decisions, because otherwise it is hard to conceive why a six-figure income with very little expenses could get them in this position. The record supported that this was not the wife's doing. As a matter of fact, the things that the husband faulted the wife for example, he said she took a vacation to Texas, and the record showed that it was because her mom and her brother had died and she went to settle their estates, and he characterized that as a vacation that he took issue
what
with.
What was the origin and closing argument of the offer of the $9,000 plus credit? What led to that?
An attempt to settle the issue, partly. The court had asked for proposed schemes of distribution, and so we each drafted, and those are in the record as well. I will be the first to acknowledge that the court exceeded what we had put in our proposed scheme of distribution. It went, she gave an award that exceeded that. That, to me, is not impermissible. It's not a proposed scheme. It's not anything that's required.
Let me ask you, I mean, certainly when people make proposals, they're trying to bring the matter to fruition, to settle it. But this was in closing argument, and if I recall, and I have it actually right in front of me right now, I think it is very fair we gave him credit for the debt that he did pay down and acknowledge that according to our distribution, he should receive a credit of approximately $9,000 towards her total award. If that's what's offered in closing argument, how does a trial court really have authority to go beyond that? Because it seems at that point you're not asking. You're saying that's very fair. It's for the court. Its court should do that.
If I recall, and the reason why I characterize it as being fair is that Mr. Osveden was arguing that he should get credit for example, payments he had made post-separation for the kids' Xbox subscriptions or lunch money and things like that. And so what I was attempting to do was highlight the fact that there were things that we acknowledged that he had paid down post-separation that would be fair to credit him with. I don't think that we set by saying that in closing argument, that I set an upper ceiling and saying, Judge, you should not award her more than that. I think the judge, when looking at the totality of everything, and frankly, there were things that came out during evidence that I didn't necessarily expect to come out. And so in drafting my proposed scheme of distribution, certainly, had I known that some of the things would come out in testimony, I probably would have changed some of the things that I had put in there.
I know it indicates your time has expired, but I gave opposing counsel, Mr. Watson, about another 2.5 minutes. So if you want to take up to about 2:30 and summarize for us, wrap up.
Judge, if I could just address the sufficiency of the evidence claim that he had gone through, I think we've kind of beaten the support issue. She was the primary breadwinner throughout the marriage, the evidence did support that she supported the household financially so that he could earn his PhD. This was a joint decision that the marriage had made. She sacrificed her own career ambitions to be able to do that. When he did obtain his PhD, she did agree to move from her home in Texas to relocate to Virginia solely to support his career. They had an agreement that she would stay home with the children. They planned these children. It was done through IVF, and so this was a plan that they had that she would stay home. And so his ability to be the primary breadwinner was largely due to what she had contributed non-monetarily throughout the marriage. I would also ask the court to consider his negative non-monetary contribution, which is his conduct during the marriage, which included negative impact on the children. The record showed that at least one of the children had to receive counseling because of it. The evidence also showed that it was a 14-year marriage before the separation, and that she put her eggs in his basket financially. She completely trusted him with all of the finances. She was not aware of the debts that were being incurred in his name, and the evidence showed that, for example, immediately, literally within 48 hours, I think it was, after separation, he took out a $4,000 advance on her credit card to pay off or pay down one of his credit cards. The fact that the circumstances of the dissolution of the marriage, and Mr. Watson has said that it's being treated as a punishment. It's not a punishment. It's just an acknowledgement that what she had anticipated her life being like, and the fact that she didn't accumulate retirement funds and all of this, did not happen as a direct result of his abusive conduct from her. I'd also note that the evidence
Evans,
that showed...
You do need to wrap up pretty quickly now.
Of the $7,000 in the BMW, for example, she had paid down $5,000 of that post-separation, and so I think the court took that into consideration, as well as the fact that she maintained the mortgage on the home from 2012 on post-separation and paid down the principal on that. And again, reminding the court that he seized over $20,000 immediately after separation and completely froze her out of the asset. So I think the evidence was more than sufficient to support the court's ruling.
Thank you, Ms. Evans. Mr. Watson, I did promise that we had so many questions for you as well. I did promise you 1 minute of rebuttal.
On the issue of the question of the timeliness of the spousal support, Judge, if you look at page 334 of the appendix, starting at line 10, the court talks about, and this is from the hearing back in February, the February... What was it, 18th, I believe, February 18 hearing. Judge Hammond says, well, I'm persuaded that's a valid objection. I think that should be set on the docket for determination of spousal support to be included in the final decree. Now, it had previously been raised by Mr. Osvedon pro se back in November. That's in the transcript also. But here she's saying, okay, we're going to hear permanent support, and that's what that March 10th hearing was for. So to suggest that on March 16, when the written motion was filed, everyone was caught by surprise would be inaccurate. And the last statement is, no one would have been prejudiced by the court hearing and going forward on that motion at that time. And Thank you,
Mr. Watson. And we appreciate the argument by counsel. Court's going to take a brief recess after we greet counsel. When we return, the next case on the docket will be Willie Anderson Cullup versus Commonwealth.